Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is brought to you by the Era Media Group, publishers of ShowSite Magazine. Together, we are strong supporters of the American Kennel Club and the preservation of our purebred dogs. Okay, crew, before we get into today's show, I am super excited to tell you about something new here at Pure Dog Talk. We know breeders are the lifeblood of our sport. We celebrate and honor our master breeders. So we're bringing you Breeders' Voice. Breeders' Voice sits down with top breeders, sharing their secrets, how they got where they are, the joys, and maybe even the heartbreaks. If you haven't had a chance, click the Don't Miss an Episode button so you'll get these in-depth articles delivered free along with your podcast. Sign up on our Facebook page or at puredogtalk.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and we are joined today by Vicky Ronchette. And Vicky's got some pretty fun information for us, and we're going to be talking to her about different ways you might think about training your show dog. And she's got a couple books we'll talk about. So welcome, Vicky. We're glad you could join us.
Thank you, Lauren. So happy to be here.
Excellent. So give us the 411. What's your background as a trainer? How'd you get started doing this?
Well, in the mid-80s, when I was in high school, I did a program where I learned to become a veterinary assistant. So I started early doing veterinary stuff and working with animals that way. After I graduated high school, a few years after that, I got a intact adolescent male Rottweiler who needed some training. Right. So I ended up at the local dog training club, and I started training there. That was in about 1989, I think. And then did obedience with him. You know, at the time, all you really could do was confirmation or obedience. There wasn't as many dog sports. So I did that with him. And that's where I got started.
So I've read a lot of trainers' works and all this, and they all have this blinding light, Saul on the road to Damascus, enlightening moment that changes how they train dogs. Because God knows, I started training dogs in the late 70s, early 80s, and a lot of the types of things that you're talking about, this sort of positive only approach, was definitely not a thing.
Right.
So what brought you to this place and your approach to show dogs?
Well, honestly, I also started at a dog training club, and right out of the gate, we were using corrections. So all the dogs were on either choke collars or pinch collars, and to teach behaviors, you could lure with food some, and we used food to reinforce behaviors, but generally, the behaviors were taught with some added aversives or compulsions. So leash corrections, pushing down on the back, that kind of thing. And that's how we were taught to do it, and that's how I was taught to do it. And I had a Rottweiler, and he was extremely forgiving, and he did it. He wasn't as reliable as my dogs are now or enthusiastic, but he did it and he was very resilient. As the years went on and I started working with other breeds, not working breeds, they were not as forgiving to those methods. So my main breed is Dachshunds. And when I started to try and do that with them, a lot of them couldn't take it. They weren't responsive to that type of training. And then I had been doing this for years and had success, but in teaching classes, it was hard for people, for average people in classes, to be well-timed and to feel comfortable even doing corrections. And I started to feel less comfortable with it. So I actually had a coworker when I worked at a pet hospital at the time who gave me a book to read, and it was called The Culture Clash by Jean Donaldson. And the first time I read it, I hated it because she talked about strangle collars, and it really seemed very punishing to people who were using those methods. But I realized that part of that was, I think I felt uncomfortable seeing what she had to say about doing things. So I told my friend I hated the book, and she said, read it again. And so I said, okay. And I read it again. And that is where sort of things changed for me, where I started realizing, well, why don't I just try and do it this way, and eased into it. I went from using almost nothing but prong collars to trying to go back and learn how to do it. And then in 2004, I just decided I'm just going to go buy a ranch-bred cattle dog puppy and do them all positive training and see what happens. And I purposely picked a breed that people say are hard, and it was extremely effective. And that was where it all changed for me. So I had to go back and relearn everything. And I did that. And now I'm in the method I'm in now, which is more science-based, I like to say, more positive reinforcement, more focus on what they do right and reinforcing that rather than looking for the wrong things and punishing those out.
And do you find there are individuals or individual situations that need a more adaptive process, something that isn't only one way or the other, so only positive or only correction-based?
That's such a good question. So what I tell people when people say, well, what is positive reinforcement training? Well, it's a quadrant of operant conditioning learning theory. You know, you can get into this whole thing. But really, when people say, well, when does it become not positive? And my answer is always that we all have to have our own lines in the sand of what we're willing to do, right? Or what we're not willing to do, or what's positive for us. You know, there are dogs that if you put on a prong collar on them, I mean, they literally would just be devastated and destroyed. And then there's other dogs who are like, yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? So it also depends on the individual animal. But what I subscribe to is a term that multi-species animal trainers, zookeepers, anybody who works professionally with animals is probably familiar with this term, and it's called LEMA. And it means least intrusive, minimally aversive. So what it means is that I'm going to start with positive reinforcement. If I can't get there, I might start introducing other quadrants of learning theory, meaning I might go to using timeouts or using more verbal feedback. But then for me, using physical stuff, pain or fear or intimidation, I just don't go that way. So for me, when I start getting to a part where I feel like just positive reinforcement isn't working, then I go back and I sort of try and change my training plan. So for me, the process is starting out with positive reinforcement, and then I just peel the problem apart until I see how I can fix it that way. But I really try and stay away from adding aversive, meaning physical corrections and things like that. So some people will say, well, some dogs just need it. I mean, I hear that a lot. I recently just wrote a blog article on it because I hear it a lot. Well, if you have X breed, you have to. But I don't know that you have to. I just think that some can take it easier or take it and accept it. So for me, it's still not going to be my go-to, but there are dogs who do okay with that and they don't fall apart. They don't hate their owners. But for me, it wouldn't be where I go, because if I can't get there, I'm going to look at it as a trainer error, not as an error on the learner. They're just trying to learn. So it's my responsibility to get it right for them.
So next in the training process, you're going to start with a completely positive approach. So talk to us about what that looks like for you as a trainer and as you're helping students.
Well, I'm going to try and not get too nerdy here, but I think I have to talk a little bit about learning theory in those quadrants. When we talk positive and negative, it doesn't mean good or bad. It's not positive or negative meaning happiness or sadness or anything like that. It means plus or minus. Right. So those quadrants are all about plus. Positive reinforcement means adding something desirable to the animal. So that frequency of that behavior that you want to reinforce will happen more frequently. So reinforcement causes a behavior to go up in frequency. Punishment causes a behavior to go down in frequency. So if I want to build behavior, meaning I want to teach the animal something, I'm going to try and set the animal up to do that behavior. And there's various ways I can do that. I can shape the behavior. I can use food or an object to lure the behavior. However, I have to get the behavior so that I get it, so that I can reinforce the behavior. So that's my starting point. And a lot of times clients will say, well, I don't want him to do that. I don't want him to do, you know, whatever the behavior is. And I always say, well, what do you want him to do? Well, I don't want him to do that. But what do you want him to do? Because you can teach a few behaviors really, really solidly, and that will cause the undesirable behaviors to go away. Like, a dog can't jump on you if he has a really solid sit and he's cued to sit instead. But I could spend a lifetime trying to punish out behaviors, millions of behaviors, all sorts of behaviors, when if I just focus on reinforcing some valuable behaviors, I could cue those behaviors to get instead of the ones I don't like.
And I think your example of don't jump but sit instead is a great example. And you could focus on that a little bit and expand on that in terms of my dog's undesirable behavior is flinging himself at me or flinging himself at guests. I have a 75-pound wire hair pointer who loves everyone and would love to just hug them. So my process with him then is to teach him, now in my case, I don't particularly want a sit command personally because of pointing dogs and show dogs and all of that. So talk to us about building in, say, for example, a stand to greet or pick your desired behavior and then how we're going to shape that or build that or train that in.
Well, I think in the example you just gave me, you could use a stand, but what I use a lot of times for something like that would be a stationing behavior. So if you ever go to zoos or see animal training on that level, and it's usually professional zookeepers I know, and those types of animal trainers have really beautiful, exquisite training. They have to, because for some of them, it means safety. So stationing means that, let's say you have this big dog and he jumps on people. You don't want to teach him to sit. And it's really hard for him probably to stand without jumping. And then you can get sort of that in between where he's leaping around a little bit, but he's not technically jumping on people. So for what I do for those dogs a lot is I'll teach them a station behavior. And that means that the dog has to go to a station, and it could be a mat or it could be a climb platform. Like I have just one of those climbs in my house. Mm-hmm. And the dog's cue is to go to that. And the only way he gets access to guests or people is if he goes to his platform. So that you've taught him a stationing behavior to where if you did it really well, as soon as someone walks in, he should run over and get on his platform and wait to be greeted. Because we're giving him an alternate behavior to do and a behavior that he can get right. So you're not going to get any fallout. Let's say the dog jumps on people, so they tell guests, knee him in the chest. Well, you know, if you have a dog who's really, really resilient and not touch sensitive, probably like your dog, that could work, but it also could make dogs uncomfortable with people, and it could be a little damaging to the relationship with the owner, and there's other fallout that could happen. And the dog's not having an opportunity to get anything right. I would rather he learn something to do that I like and then reinforce the heck out of that behavior. Because then the reinforcement becomes the people greeting him. He does get what he wants after he's doing the behavior you want.
And I think so much of dog training, and I think we sort of lose sight of this, and I talk to people about this all the time, like with crate training, for example. What the dog wants is to be free of the dog crate. So if he screams his head off and you let him out of the dog crate, bazinga, he has gotten what he wanted. He's trained
exactly
well, as I say.
Absolutely. What happens in that instance, like if people are wanting to get rid of the behavior of barking in the crate, is that they will hear from somebody that the best way to deal with that is to ignore the behavior. And that can work really well as long as you continue to ignore the behavior through the behavior. Because what's going to happen is before it gets better, it's going to get worse. So the barking will turn into howling, will turn into scraping, will turn into biting the bars, will turn into all this horrible stuff. And that's when people cave. Oh my God, this isn't working. It's getting worse. So they let him out. And when you let him out during that, what's called an extinction burst, you can actually really cement the behavior in. So I don't want to do that when that's happening, because then you're teaching persistence.
What you've just described, German Wirehair Pointers is my breed, and I think many of the sporting dogs we see out there and all that sort of thing, that's a very common problem we run into, and it builds into separation anxiety, and it does all this other stuff.
So for things like the crate, you just want to teach the dog, or you want to condition the dog, that the crate can be as valuable as being out of the crate. So you have to build value in that crate. And then also I do a lot of choice in the beginning, where the animal's truly allowed to choose in the crate, out of the crate, in the crate, out of the crate. And then you start building up duration in the crate, instead of just putting them in the crate and locking them in there where it can be really scary. Not usually for a little puppy. You start with an 8-week-old puppy, they cry a little bit, and then they stop, and they usually just get it. It's usually when they're a little bit older and they're already getting into this mode of being panicked in there.
And again, I think it goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about individuals within a breed, certain breed types. I mean, purebred dogs, we have that built-in predictability, right? This is what we're aiming for.
Absolutely.
So when you have a breed that's bred to be really, really determined.
And really, really social, right?
Exactly.
And I love that you said that because, you know, my breed of heart is dachshunds. And I get incredibly frustrated when people call them stubborn and they're this and they're that, because we developed them to be persistent.
Yes.
They're supposed to be independent, free-thinking, working dogs that are able to go make decisions. They're not supposed to look at us and say, what should I do now? They're supposed to say, I've got it. We made them that way. We wanted it. We needed that at one point.
Exactly. We could have an entire conversation and have had on other shows about the predictability of purebred dogs and how that applies to your selection of which dog should come into your household. But that's a whole nother
Absolutely.
Story.
Absolutely. But it does bring us back to training. And I have a mentor who's more of a mentor in parrots because I also work with parrots and birds of prey. And so she's my bird mentor, Laura Joseph. And one thing she always says, because of course she's working more with exotics, is that if you're going to take away something that is a natural behavior for the animal, you better be able to replace it with something else because that is a natural behavior. So take flying and birds. You know, if you're going to clip their wings, you better be able to replace it with something else. You're going to cause a lot of frustration in that animal if they cannot do what they normally are born and hardwired to do. And I think that's true with dogs too. Like a lot of people get frustrated if their dog sniffs in the ring. But if you have a dog, and sometimes sniffing is stress related, but I'm talking about a dog who just likes to use his nose. If you ask him never to use his nose in the ring, then you're not making the ring a very fun place and you're really going to be fighting with that. I would prefer to teach him a legal sniffing cue so that when I ask him not to sniff, he can do it. And when I tell him he can sniff, he can do it. Nice. And it's very clear. And to me, it's more fair and reasonable. Because to ask a dog not to sniff at a dog show is like asking us to close our eyes the whole time we're there.
Right. Yeah, it's the same type of behavior conversation. If you don't want your dog to dig, give it a place that it can dig.
Yes, exactly.
So let's turn this basic concept, right? And now we're going to aim it at you're developing a great show dog. So let's give three strong building blocks for making a great show dog.
So first I'm going to say train the dog because people wouldn't dream into going to the obedience ring or the agility ring with an untrained dog, but they will go into the confirmation ring and expect that dog to perform and to perform to the level that they want it to be successful and highly competitive. And that's not reasonable. It's not reasonable to expect them to be able to just go in there, do it well. It looks easy because professional, fantastic, fabulous handlers like you make it look easy. It's just walking around, right? It's just standing there, right?
Just
a person's
like that.
Just touching it. Yeah, so train the dog. That's the first thing, because it's so much easier when they really understand what to do. Another thing I would say is to train with positive reinforcement, because what people don't realize is that however a behavior is learned, the emotional state of the learner during the learning lives with that behavior forever. So if I train a behavior with joy and enthusiasm and eagerness, then those emotional states are going to live with that behavior. There are things that you know that you teach and the dog gets really excited about. It's because part of it is that the process was fun for them. They enjoy doing that. So I try and make things like lead work really fun for them. I'm not a fan of just, quote, lead breaking, which is a term I hate, because usually what it means is just putting a puppy on and walk them around until they get sick of dragging, they get sick of sitting down, they get sick of being pulled, so eventually they start to walk. That's actually negative reinforcement, where the aversive is being pulled and drug and all these things, and eventually they get sick of all that and they start walking, and then there's no more pressure. But what I like to do instead is start moving them and just reinforcing every little bit of movement I get, and then I'm building the behavior from the ground up and also building that positive response with the behavior. So using fun methods and positive methods, I think, are really, really powerful. Another thing that I'll say is that, so professional trainers who are not show people will say, oh, it's ridiculous. They don't want the dogs to learn to sit. Oh, come on. You know, dogs know how to learn to sit. They can learn how to sit even if they're a show dog. But I never make my show dog people teach their dog to sit unless they want to. I mean, it's all about what each person wants. But I find that the behavior that I teach first becomes the most strongest, and we call that their default behavior. So for my dogs that I know I'm going to show, their default behavior is a stand, and that's the first thing I train. So that if they're in the ring and the owner has performance anxiety and doesn't know what to do and freaks out, the dog is going to throw their default behavior at you, and I'd rather it be a stand and not a sit.
Beautiful. I love that. And I think that that's where a lot of folks get stuck. Their first thing they teach the puppy is sit down for your bowl of food in the kitchen. That's great, but as you say, becomes the, what do I do when I'm nervous? I sit down.
And when my owner's not giving me feedback, you don't have this problem because this is what you do. But if you're like an owner handler and you're new to this and you're sort of scared anyways and you feel all self-conscious being in there, you stop giving the dog the normal feedback. People start getting fidgety. They're doing things they don't normally do in training. They're looking at the judge. They're getting all weird. And the dog doesn't know what this whole new thing is all about, and they just sit down. So I think dogs are comfortable when they know what's about to happen, when they have some predictability and they know what to expect. So we can teach them these things so that it comes very naturally. But what happens is that people teach sit and they reinforce a bunch of sits and they don't even know how to reinforce stands. That's like a little trickier. They don't teach you that in puppy school. They work on sits and downs and come here and things like that. So teaching a stand first is one of the first things that I do with all my new show puppies. So when I have, you know, a bunch of dogs here, and the ones who are show dogs usually stand when I hand out cookies.
Yes.
And the pet dogs sit because that's what they were taught. And the beauty of it is that I'm the one holding the cookie. I can reinforce whatever I want, you know? And so whatever I reinforce, I'm going to get more of.
Exactly. And I think what you're talking about is building a mindset in our owners and our exhibitors that is useful for raising this new puppy. So my puppies all start out in the dog room. Everybody gets a cookie. They have to watch me. They have to stand there. They have to go in their dog crate. Whatever it is that I want them to do is reinforced with a cookie. And it's almost never sit.
Right. It's behaviors that are useful to you. And for me, I want dogs to own life skill behaviors. I want dogs to own those behaviors so they know what they can give and be reinforced for. If a dog doesn't know what to do, I want him to know that just walking up to a person and standing there politely is a 100% almost surefire way to get reinforced. Because then you're going to get more of that behavior. Every moment we're with them, they're learning. Whether or not we have a clicker or a treat bag, they're learning from us. And it's up to us to always be looking at the behavior that we're getting and then making the decision to reinforce it or not.
That right there, what you just said, Vicki, I think that is so incredibly important. And I think people need to hear that. Every single interaction we have with our dogs is training.
And learning. Yep, okay. Absolutely.
So how we approach that, how we think about it, how we interact with that dog in every single situation, whether it's the first day they come home or their last day with us, that is a learning opportunity.
Absolutely. Even when I walk up to a pen of puppies, just a little puppies that are in their pen. They haven't been trained to do anything. They're just little tiny puppies. Maybe they're 6 weeks old. And they're all screaming and jumping up at the side of the pen, right? They all want out, and they're all being crazy. I just stand there and wait. And the moment someone sits down, I say, good, and I pick them up. In that moment, that puppy has learned an alternate behavior to jumping and screaming. I didn't put a lot of effort into it, but he figured it out for himself. I wasn't pushing him off. I wasn't trying to make behavior happen. I waited for what he had to give me that wasn't the one I didn't want. And I went, that's it, dude. I'm picking you up. Good job. And that stays with them. And it stays with them for their life if you do it when they're babies.
So this is one of my personal mantras. So I'd like you to speak to it because I think it will appeal to you as well. Firm, fair, and consistent. So
yes.
If it's wrong, it's wrong every time. If it's right, it's right every time. And they have to know what it is that you're asking them to do.
Right. It has to be clear. And that's where it falls on us. That's where we're responsible, so that it's crystal clear. And people have all different ways of getting there. But I think that some people think that positive reinforcement is just about throwing cookies around and ignoring things we don't like and just walking around in a cloud of sunshine, pretending like nothing bad is happening. But it's not that. It's really well thought out. So for me, I think I'm firm. My dogs do jump all over. I mean, they're excited, happy dogs. I don't feel a lot like training sometimes when I get home because that's all I do. And I also choose breeds that's very manageable. If I had a house full of shepherds, I would need to implement different types of training or people would get hurt. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I get to decide what's important and what I'm going to train them to do. But there are clear rules and boundaries. And while I don't use pain or intimidation, my dogs are told to knock it off. Or to get off of there. Or if you do that again, you're going to get in the crate or you're not going to be allowed to go outside right now. It's all balances out to where there are good consequences for good things and not so good consequences for other things. But on my consequences, it's just not going to be things that I don't feel comfortable doing. But we all have our own minds. And those of us who are good know our dogs. And we know what they need.
So thank you very much, Vicki. We appreciate you joining us here at Pure Dog Talk. And I know that our listeners will be looking forward to your next episode that we're going to talk about some of the books you've published and also some very specific types of problem solving that we can work on, okay?
That sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Vicki. All right, crew, we are back with Allison Foley and her tip of the week to give you the leading edge with your show dog. So Allison's going to talk to us today about something of a forgotten art, I think, and that is remembering to check your tear sheets.
As somebody that shows a lot of poodles, it is heartbreaking to think that your Canadian champion has 10 points or your American champion has 15 points. And to get that letter, phone them, and find out that you, in fact, can't count to 10 or 15 anymore. That's a heartbreaking lesson in itself. But when you have a poodle and you think that it's a champion and it has really awful hair or it needs to go to a home where the owners can't take care of the hair and you have shaved off all of its hair, it becomes a whole other beast entirely.
That just makes me cry.
Yes, I have cried several times over this. So a lot of things can happen when you're counting points, you know, especially in the United States, you have different zones. So you can think that, oh, yeah, it does take 6 dogs for a major here, but really you've crossed the state line and it takes 7 there and you mark it down wrong in your book. Or you don't realize that a dog was entered in 2 different classes. You know, the same dog was entered in 2 different classes, therefore counts as 1 dog. So there was only 5 there and not 6. There's all sorts of different, you know, and you can just miscount. You can just think all 6 were there when really somebody was absent, right? You were thinking of the day before, the week before, 4 years before. I mean, that's happened to all of us. So my tip for everyone is about an hour after judging, sometimes a little bit longer at some bigger shows, if you go to the show superintendent, they are going to have what's called tear sheets. They're sometimes yellow, but they're going to have them usually hanging in group order, and you are just going to go to those sheets. It's going to have exactly how many dogs and bitches were there. It's going to have notes on which ones were moved to the best of breed class, notes on which ones were absent or excused or disqualified for whatever reason. And then you can count exactly how many dogs were there competing for the points. And then there is absolutely no mistake. You're ready to go. You can be happy that you know exactly how many points your dog won.
And you can verify that the judge wrote down your armband number properly.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, exactly. So you can be totally right, and the judge can write down 15 instead of 17, especially a lot of those people who put combs. I'm like an offender. You know, I put the comb on my rubber band, on my armband, and sometimes the judge is like, is that a 3 or a 5? Or, you know what I mean? And it's very, very easy for the judge. And, you know, a lot of times they're just looking at their sheet and they can just put the 1 up or down a spot, especially in those big classes. So, yes, make sure that not only do you count, but you read. That is my number. I was number 15. Number 15 is marked as winners and as best of winners or whatever award it is that you're going for. Very, very important. In this day and age, I see a lot of people even just taking a photo of the sheets with their smartphone. And I thought, oh, like, that's a great idea, right?
Well, and I think, too, back in the day, we didn't have the internet. Right? We didn't have any way to check on these things right away. And so as professional handlers, and this is something I think is a lost art for professional handlers, that was how you prove to your clients that you showed the dog.
Exactly. Exactly. And yes, you're right. Now that there is the internet, I mean, I think myself included, I've gotten a lot more lax about checking the tear sheets, and it can make a huge difference, especially if you take that poodle home and you shave off his hair. You know, you're 6, 8, 10 months away from getting 1 point on it to finish it. So just a good tip, go check, and you're right. Make sure it does say your number. It's not good, just good enough to make sure there were 6 or 8 or 10, but make sure it says that you actually won.
Yeah, that's the one that I've gotten caught up in more than once, where I know I went winner's dog and got a major and whatever, judge wrote the wrong number, and then I'm running around like an idiot trying to find a photo, trying to find this, oh my God. So I'm just saying, check your tear sheets.
Yeah. Yeah, it just, you know, for 5 minutes, it saves 5 hours worth of headache. And it's
or 5 days I've gone through. Thank you, Allison. I sure appreciate
Thanks,
your time.
Laura.
Listeners, don't forget Pure Dog Talk 25 in the checkout box when you purchase one of Allison Foley's Leading Edge Academy dog show classes. And that will give you a 25% discount on your purchase price and pay for your next dog show entry. So, thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk, brought to you by the Aramedia Group, publisher of ShowSite Magazine, your home for purebred dogs.